Voice Radio here on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk. What a fascinating conversation we just had with Patrick Clausen, Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And I am highly looking forward to learn a little bit more about the situation within Iran from our next guest, Mr. Ken Timmerman, a consultant with expertise in terrorist-related asset collection, especially in Iran, Iraq, and Middle East terrorist groups. He's the president of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran at Iran.org, formed in 1995, and was the Republican nominee in Maryland's 8th Congressional District in 2012. Mr. Timmerman, as we try to get you back on the program, I think that you can hear us, but we still have to get you back on. Otherwise, there's been some work that we've seen him do, which is fascinating in terms of some statements that he's been able to make. Mr. Timmerman recently said that if there is such a thing as an irreplaceable man in the Iranian regime, Qassem Soleimani, he's the guy, even more important to the regime than the supreme leader. We're going to ask him about that. We're also going to ask him, what does this mean going forward for Iran, meaning that the regime's irreplaceable man is gone? And in an interview last night, Mr. Timmerman also spoke about the Iranian missile attack, calling it extraordinary, and that it was carried out openly by Iran, not by surrogates. Should we expect more of the same? So, Mr. Timmerman, you're with us?
I am indeed. Good morning.
All right. We were just going over some of the prescient analysis that you've been putting forth for the past few years and especially for the past few days. I'll repeat it again to get right back into it. You said recently that there is such a thing as an irreplaceable man in the Iranian regime, referring to Qassem Soleimani, more important to the regime than the supreme leader. Please explain.
Qassem Soleimani had his fingers in every terrorist plot. He was the spider at the center of the web. He was the one who conducted all of Iran's overseas operations, terror operations, military operations. He personally, physically went to Syria, to Lebanon, to Iraq, to Yemen, to all of these different places to oversee his operations. He put in place his trusted lieutenants to carry out spectacular terrorist operations, such as the 9/11 attacks against the United States and the attack in Benghazi in 2012. These have been documented, by the way. It's not very well known in the United States, the Iranian involvement in those two particular terrorist attacks, but it has been very well documented.
Just go back to that for a second. What did you say about 9/11 and Soleimani?
So Qassem Soleimani has also been the one to delegate his top lieutenant to carry out the 9/11 plot. He was a liaison with al-Qaeda to carry out the 9/11 plot. This began, as I wrote in my 2005 book, Countdown to Crisis, with the number two, Zawahiri, traveling to Iran in January of 2001. And then in May of 2001, the son of bin Laden, Saad bin Laden, traveling to Iran to cement the relationship and cement their cooperation. We established, and I say we, lawyers for the victims of 9/11, the families of victims of 9/11, established in the Southern District of New York court in a decision handed down in 2011 that the Iranians delegated the relationship to al-Qaeda for this plot to Imad Mughniyeh. Mughniyeh was a creature of Qassem Soleimani. He was a Lebanese terrorist that Israel finally dispatched in February of 2008 in Damascus, and Mughniyeh was the point man for that liaison.
I have to just push back for a second that I will acknowledge that Qassem Soleimani was a figure involved with liaising with al-Qaeda, both before and after 9/11. But the 9/11 Commission report, which has no mention of Soleimani whatsoever, said that investigators found no evidence that Iran was involved with or had prior knowledge of the 9/11 attacks. Moreover, while they may have knowingly aided al-Qaeda in carrying out attacks in Afghanistan and even aided and abetted the transfer of al-Qaeda members both before and after 9/11 through Iran, including providing housing for some 10 years for al-Qaeda's membership that were actively trying to get away from the United States. I got to push back on that and say, I don't think that they were responsible for 9/11. Can we agree to disagree?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I first got interested in that connection when I learned of a defector from Iranian intelligence named Hamid Reza Zakri, who had given an interview in 2003 to an Arabic language newspaper in London. And he had been personally present at these two meetings I just mentioned to you. And later I went and talked to the individual on the 9/11 commission, first one of the commissioners, a former Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, and he steered me to the staff director, who at the very last week before they handed in the report in July of 2004, was called down to the NSA to go through the last box and the last stack of documents that they had found, with 75 highly classified NSA intercepts showing exactly what the U.S. government knew at that point about Hezbollah and Iran's involvement in the 9/11 attacks. And it was quite a lot. They crunched that down to pages 240 and 241 in the report. And the conclusion was, if, as you say, they could not prove that Iran was involved, but how else explain this pattern of travel where a senior Hezbollah operative, who they were instructed not to name, and the staff individual told me that was Imad Mugdieh, how explain Mugdieh's repeated travels ferrying these 8 to 10 of the Mosul hijackers and others to Iran?
I don't want to focus too much on this just because we have a lot more to focus on today, but I will give you the credit. The report said, and I quote, 8 to 10 of the 14 Saudi Mosul operatives traveled into or out of Iran between October 2000 and February 2001, and that several of the 9/11 hijackers took advantage of the Iranian practice of not stamping Saudi passports, a policy Iran instituted to improve relations with al-Qaeda. So, like I said, aiding and abetting, yeah, direct involvement in planning, maybe they were aware, but fingerprints still not as evident as maybe needed. Definitely open to further investigation,
I would suggest that you read the information, because I have put it out there in writing. You can take your at your leisure. It's in Countdown to Crisis. There's several chapters about it. It's also in the court hearings. You can go to Iran911case.com and read some of the affidavits. Iran has a long track record of cooperation with Sunni terrorist groups. It's something that's not very well known, and for many years the CIA.
You're 100% right. If you look at from your website here, and I'm quoting a document that's up there. In 2016, the U.S. Treasury Department identified and sanctioned three senior al-Qaeda operatives residing in Iran, and noted that Iran has knowingly permitted these AQ members, including several of the 9/11 hijackers, to transit its territory on their way to Afghanistan for training and operational planning. You are on the mark on this. It's just that if we look at the relationship from 9/11 to 15 years later, they're already sanctioning al-Qaeda members that are still in Iran and in Tehran today. We must acknowledge there's a relationship there. But the extent and the depth of it is a conversation that I'd like to have another time, specifically because, as you said recently, that Soleimani is irreplaceable. I want to challenge this for a second, because I'd like to look at two specific examples of Iranian proxy groups that had received significant support from the Al-Quds Brigade, not Brigade, but the Al-Quds Division of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and also that of other Iranian proxy training forces like the MOIS, the Ministry of Intelligence Services. When the Israeli government decided to assassinate the head of Hezbollah in the early 90s, there was this idea that by taking out the leader, you would get someone who would be more inclined to be reformed and may not be as violent or as nefarious as the previous head of Hezbollah. In return, we got Hassan Nasrallah. The same instance happened when there was efforts to take out leaders of terror organizations like al-Qaeda, and we ended up with people who are much more vicious and much more dangerous. Is Soleimani's replacement, Issam Ghani, more or less dangerous than him?
Much less dangerous. He does not have the web of connections. He does not have the charisma. He's not looked up to by his subordinates the way that Soleimani was. Soleimani was greeted as a hero when he would move around amongst his people. He was greeted as the devil by people in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Iran itself, who had aspirations of freedom. But he would command a legion of devoted followers and people willing to carry out his commands. And that was a personal relationship. I think it was there was something deeply personal about it. Let me put it that way.
And maybe shifting strategy within Iran. You said last night in an interview that Iran's missile attack in Iraq was extraordinary and that it was carried out openly by Iran, not by surrogates, as is its standard practice. Should we expect more of the same of direct kinetic conflict between Iran and the U.S., or maybe a combination of both proxy and direct action?
Well, again, they normally act through proxies. They normally act in ways that are can be plausibly denied, right? In this case, they openly said and declared that they were behind this missile attack, and then their missiles completely failed to do any damage. So you've got to wonder, what was their reasoning behind this attack? If they had killed Americans with this missile attack, I have no doubt that President Trump would have responded with overwhelming force, and they would have paid a huge price for that. Now, did they misunderstand the president to that extent that they were unaware that they would pay a price for the attack? I think there it's an open question. It's an open question. We heard from the Ayatollah Khamenei today that he considered this a slap against America. Well, that's just pathetic and transparent, and everybody knows it. So I just have an open. It's really an open question for me. Was this done by a group within the Revolutionary Guards that was openly hoping to provoke America to a dramatic military escalation of the conflict? That's really what my question is.
So William Galston writes this morning in the Wall Street Journal an article titled, "Will the U.S. and Iran Blunder into War?" This last question that he puts, where he says, the risk is that Iran, confident that Mr. Trump won't wage war during an election year, will miscalculate by staging a spectacular attack that takes many American lives. This would force Mr. Trump to choose between a conflict he doesn't want and looking weak, which he cannot stand. What do you think the president's going to say in 15 minutes when he addresses America from the White House on the, I'd even call it a faux missile launch attempt to show strength, but to strike a few desert patches outside of American air bases in Iraq?
Well, Greg, this is always a fool's errand to predict what President Trump is going to say ahead of time. But what I can imagine him saying and what he could be saying, which would be very useful, I think, is that the United States has drawn a red line. If you shed American blood, we will respond dramatically with overwhelming force, and you will pay a tremendously high price. Don't even think about it. And I think that's, you can see that with his reaction to the drone strike when the Iranians, took down a U.S. drone in the springtime, and he was given the option of a counterstrike. And he said he called it off a half an hour before the planes were to launch after asking the generals how many people were going to die. And they said, well, about 150, sir. He said, that's disproportionate. It was an unmanned drone. So I think the president has shown, if you take American life, we will absolutely go after you. The rest of it, if you want to play around in your sandbox, we've got other means, non-kinetic means, to do you damage.
You spend a lot of time working with Persian diaspora organizations. What's the reaction coming out of the diaspora outside of Iran?
Overwhelmingly in favor of what the president has done. I mean, overwhelmingly. And also inside Iran, you see, people are posting videos inside Iran, some of them where they veil their face or cover half of their face, but others of them, women, who are speaking right into the camera and saying, Mr. Trump, we love you. Thank you for what you have done. Qasem Soleimani was considered by freedom-loving Iranians not just a terrorist, but a man who played a key role in the repressive apparatus who was all in when Iran would send the Basij onto the rooftops to use fire on crowds with snipers, fire on peaceful protesters. There was an event near Abbas in protest about 3 or 4 weeks ago where they rounded up about 120 people who had tried to escape demonstrations in the center of this smaller town. They rounded them up out in the marshland and just gunned them down with machine guns. All right. And this was caught on video. It was absolutely stunning and horrific. It reminded you of some of the worst things that the you would hear from World War II in the forests of Poland.
It reminds me of Baba Yar.
Right. I mean, so he was an evil character, and Iranians are thanking us for it. And Iranians in this country are, I think, overwhelmingly supporting the president as a result.
Now, let's talk about an organization in Washington that claims to represent a majority of American Iranians, the National Iranian American Council, NIAC. Tomorrow, they'll be hosting a call with Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, ostensibly in opposition to American action against Iran. I find this surprising. My colleague Sam Westrop notes that if this is true, they're basically speaking on a conference call with an organization that has clear ties to the Iranian regime. What do you make of this? I mean, NIAC has put a petition together. They've been organizing anti-war protests. They've been calling for a return to the nuclear deal. What's their deal here? Why are they doing this?
Okay, first of all, NIAC does not represent the Iranian-American community. They are hated by
the Iranians. I agree 100%. They're doing it under the moniker, the semblance of claiming to, which they obviously don't.
Right. But you should not be surprised that people like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Chris Van Hollen, for that matter, who I ran against in 2012 in Maryland in Congress, should be supporting NIAC because they share their goals and they share their views that America is at fault. And Iran is just, you know, an innocent victim of American imperialism. This is a view in the American left. It's profoundly mistaken, I believe. But in the case of NIAC, people should actually be a little bit more cautious because the former head of NIAC, a guy named Trita Parsi, was openly taking part on the Iranian side in the negotiations in Lausanne that led up to the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, he was there with the Iranian negotiators on their side when they were meeting with Americans. I mean, it's absolutely stunning to see something like that. The guy ought to be in jail.
I mean, he's now organizing this Quincy Initiative on American Statecraft, I think it's called, against the fake news and foreign influence. It's being funded by the Koch brothers. That's pretty troubling, considering who they support politically or some individuals who otherwise would support ash against Iran. But while we're on the subject of American politicians, there was a letter that was sent out on December 12th, prior to the start of many of these protests they were making mention of, where the response from the IRGC and the regime supporters was nothing less than a massacre, as you point out, from some 14, 15 members of Congress. Raul Grijalva, Ilhan Omar, Andre Carson, Pramila Jayapal, Mark Pocan, Ayanna Pressery, Rashida Tlaib, a lot of the squad members, right, that are called here. And it was calling for 100% of the sanctions, which was in a letter to the Treasury Department, 100% of the sanctions being lifted against Iran. The last sentence in this letter said, "The administration's sanctions campaign is in direct contradiction with the stated overarching goal of supporting the human rights of the Iranian people and their aspirations for democracy and freedom. It should be made a priority to remedy the adverse consequences of these sanctions to ensure that Iranians have the basic human right of access to quality, affordable medicine." So they're talking about pharmaceuticals. Fine, whatever. What is wrong with these members of Congress not understanding that the sanctions actually galvanize democratic opposition to the regime rather than suppressing it?
Right. Well, you know, there used to be a time in American politics where we would say our differences stopped at the nation's shore. And those times are long gone. They're long over. We no longer have a united view towards foreign policy, towards American national security interests, or towards America's role in the world. You have people who come out of a Marxist, a radical left-wing background who now have made their way into Congress, who've made their way into major newspapers, who believe that America is the source of all evil in the world. and therefore America must be defeated. America must be fundamentally transformed, to use a phrase, and we must support the victims of this American imperialism, such as this wonderful, wonderful democratic free regime in Iran. That is, oh, it's religious. We should be supporting it. They're about Islam. They're conservative. Well, I'd like to say in response, they're as conservative as Joseph Stalin was conservative. It's really an insult to conservatism to call somebody like Ayatollah Khamenei a conservative, right? He's a thug. Soleimani was a thug. They're not conservatives. They're totalitarians. So we have come to a state in American politics where these radical leftists are now taken seriously by the media, and I think that's a stain on our body politic as well as a stain on the media. Shame on them.
Now, we have a fellow that works at the Middle East Forum. His name is A.J. Cachetta, and he speaks about the nature of the Iranian protests, an article he wrote for The Hill on December 2nd, not being about the price of gasoline, but with protesters chanting on the streets, no to Gaza, no to Lebanon, leave Syria and think of us, and even death to Palestine, as he writes, indicating that something much larger than the price of gas drove their outrage. We now see the dean of Iranian proxy activity, Qasem Soleimani, in the grave. And whoever follows up with him, you made the point, won't be another Soleimani. And I don't know about that. We have to see what, in my opinion, Qasem Ghani is going to do. He's been his deputy he was his deputy until he died for the last 23 years. And perhaps he had some sort of other genius in Pakistan and Afghanistan where he was responsible for. But we'll, you know, leave that for a debate a year from now to see where the IRGC and its Al-Quds division is. But I got to ask you about this. These protests taking place 6 weeks ago didn't have millions of people on the streets, but they were in over 100 cities in Iran. Where does internal Iranian politics go now that they have lost their chief proxy operator, but at the same time, there is massive outrage, at least witnessed by those people on the streets, against the United States? Where does this put the two camps, one pushing for democracy, the other pushing for the deification of Soleimani?
I think what you've seen, that you mentioned outrage against the United States, I would call it faux outrage. These are rent-a-mobs, rent-a-crowds. The regime always does this when they want to impress the cameras. They give government employees, and there are a lot of them in Iran, the day off, and then they bus them into major cities, they pay for the buses, and stage them in front of the cameras. Probably, by best estimates, there's somewhere between 5% and 10% of the population that are ardent supporters of the regime. They are the ones who are chanting death to America. They are the ones who are getting benefits from the regime, if you wish. But the overwhelming majority of people inside the country are on the fence, kind of going along, keeping their heads down. And then you have an active portion of 10 to 20% who actually take to the streets. What is going to happen now? The regime has lost the aura of invincibility. They are no longer invulnerable. People were afraid, or had been afraid up until the death of Soleimani, that nothing they could do could shake the regime. Now they see, aha, if the United States can take out Soleimani, perhaps we can take out the regime. I think you're going to see a toughening of these demonstrations. I think you're going to see a broadening of them. And it depends. They are looking to the United States for some form of help. The thing that I've heard most frequently, that they would like to see the State Department turn on the internet when the regime turns it off, because the regime likes to kill in darkness. And I understand that the State Department does actually have the technical capabilities these days to do such a thing. So I would like to see that be part of U.S. policy, to just give some material assistance to this broad base of a pro-freedom movement inside Iran.
Yeah, let's blow out the cyber windows so they can't put the blackout curtains there anymore. I've been having this debate with one of my colleagues about what the technical capabilities are of Iran and of the United States cyber different commands and divisions. And I'm with you. I think they do have the capability of turning the internet back on. Ken, tell us about your organization, Free Iran. Tell us about what you're going to be doing over the next few days and weeks, and how can we follow your work?
Well, first go to my personal website, kentimmerman.com, where you'll have all of my articles on Qasem Soleimani in the New York Post and Front Page Mag and other places recently. The Foundation for Democracy in Iran has a legacy website, iran.org. We started out in the early days of the internet when it was when we were able to get such an address, 1995, in fact. And in the early days, again, we helped pioneer internet-based or electronic-based human rights reporting. This was during the 1999 student protests, and we got out photos of the crackdown by the regime at that point. By now, there have been so many people doing this. It's wonderful to see there's been an explosion of this, and that's why turning on or keeping on the internet during protests is so important, because you have these human rights reporters with their cell phones out there documenting the evil of the regime, and it's so important to get that out to the world. So you can go to iran.org or to kentimmerman.com and read more about all of the things we've been discussing.
Ken Timmerman, Director of Free Iran and noted author and analyst. Thank you for joining Middle East Forum Radio this morning.
So much, Greg. My pleasure.